All right, I'm here with Joe Morris and Nate Woolley. Thanks, guys, for coming up.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. It sounded really great. Really, thanks. Really happy to have you both here. Guitar and trumpet duo. I was trying to think what you're playing. I can't think of any guitar trumpet duos. I'm sure they've been out there, but
they've been out there. There's one I know in England with Henry Lowther and John Russell.
Okay.
But it's never been recorded. I've only heard of it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know what that sounds like. It should be great though.
Joe?
Yeah. I can't really think of any either. I don't know of any really. Maybe way back in the day, but not doing this kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, that's why I always think when I'm trying to think of arrangements, I'm like, you know, Coleman's band, they did that, or somebody,
Eddie Lang and Bix Beiderbecke or somebody,
right.
which is just as much an inspiration to me anyway.
Absolutely.
That's what it's all about right there.
Absolutely.
You know?
So I feel like you guys sort of are coming from different worlds in my listening sphere, and I know one answer to that is, oh, it's all just music. but maybe could like go for a different answer. And do you feel that at all? Do you feel like there's a different ground that you're both sort of reaching toward?
Well, I don't think we're reaching for different things. I know I've been around longer than Nate, so I've gone through some things that maybe he didn't have to go through or didn't bother to go through or went through easier than I did. I don't know, more easily. Playing together feels like we're just working. It's totally forward motion. There's no drawing on anything in particular that we've done or anything. I think that, I don't know what you think, but to me that's irrelevant. We're just trying to play together and make it sound like something weird that surprises us. That's what I think.
Yeah, I think I always think of this duo in particular as being something. When I play some other kinds of music, you kind of limit a certain vocabulary that you're going to use just because the rest of it doesn't make sense. But this duo, I always feel like there's no limit. It's one of the few things where there's no limitations on the vocabulary.
Okay.
I mean, you just go and everything that Joe plays sparks a different direction. And sometimes it's a noise thing. Sometimes it's playing lines. I mean, it all is open. It's a really rare experience for me, actually, to be able to just go anywhere.
It's interesting because I feel like I'm hearing you do different things, Joe, that I haven't heard you do before. And you've been around longer, so I've heard you more. But then I'm also remembering you telling me once that what guitar you play in particular depends on where you're playing. And in New York, it's usually through crap PAs, and you bring your solid body. And we're hearing archtop, but I'm not used to hearing you with the alligator clips and things like that as much.
Well, I've worked on that kind of thing since I was a teenager, I mean, anybody my age, I'm 54, back in the day, we sat around a room with a black light and used bottlenecks and, pipe cleaners and things. So I did that for a long time, but then it didn't feel, I really tried to apply kind of, avant-garde jazz saxophone language to the guitar. That's really what I worked on for a long time. I mean, the story about it gets way more complicated for some reason, but that's really what I was trying to do, was to really work on playing lines like that and to sort of play what I consider to be really modern jazz music on the guitar. But I've always had three or four, five, six different technical things running concurrent with that, and I haven't had the chance to do some of them. But I also kind of avoided a lot of the kind of timbral things, not all of them, but a lot of them, because there was a point where if you entered that world playing the guitar, everyone would say, well, you're playing like Derek Bailey.
Nah.
And the fact is, it's pretty hard to do anything that wasn't like Derek Bailey when everyone you're playing with is reacting to it like you're Derek Bailey. And in the last 5 or 10 years, it's really been since about 2000 when I kind of made a big shift in all my musical stuff. I began to sort of understand that I can keep the kind of narrative flow that I have that's connected to jazz in my playing, regardless of what sounds I make. And it really opened up a lot of different things. I give a lot of credit to a trombonist I work with named Tom Plisak, who has the ability to play like lines and timbres sort of at the same time. And that opened up the possibilities to me more, and I started looking for instruments I could play more acoustically and things like
right.
that. And you know, Nate does that too. I need like modulation when I play. I just sort of think like that. It has to move and change, and things have to happen. And not everybody who gets into timbre can do that. You know, Nate can do it. A few other people.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other part of it is I've never had a fixed idea about who I was as a guitar player. I've just never had that. I mean, people think I do because what I've had to do to earn a living, or where my focus has been, or where the main activity has been. But to me, it's always been a complete mystery what I was going to play. I mean, the whole idea of like holding the guitar and figuring out how to play it. I mean, I know how to play chords and changes and melodies and things like that. And, you know, I can teach that to people. But I always consider everything played by improvisers, and especially on the guitar, is an invention. So I tried to never set myself in a position where I knew what the limitations of any of that was, you know. So now I'm getting to show that a little bit more in different ways.
It's interesting to hear you say, because I think through the 90s and through like the time when a lot of people were first becoming aware of your music, maybe it was so associated with the Solid Body, the Black Les Paul,
yeah.
the Lines, No Effects,
yeah.
Which was brilliant. I loved
Thanks.
Your playing them, but it's interesting to hear you say that you weren't thinking of yourself as one.
No, I wrote some things in the late 70s about having a bunch of different approaches. I consider what I do, I have a very formal sort of backstory about my music in my head, you know, and I consider what I do to be like a repertoire of methodologies, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm really a product of my generation. I'm like a free music musician. So, you know, we were talking earlier, I don't have any, if I decided tomorrow to play heavy metal, I would just do it. If I want to play...
And if you do, bring it up to my show again.
Yeah, if I want to play gypsy jazz or bluegrass, I'm just going to do it.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I don't feel obligated to anything. And that's hard when you say, I want to play music, I want to be an improvised musician, I like jazz. Because all of a sudden, you become faced with what exactly are you? And I think if I said, well, I'm this or that, I know for a fact I would probably be better known and work more. I just wouldn't be happy, you know. And there was a real point about around 2000 when it was clear that I was going to have to make some decisions to repeat things that were still in process. I remember saying to my wife, like, how am I supposed to continue doing this thing that feels over, you know, because people are telling me to do it? Where were they when I started it? I mean, I didn't say, I'll get to here and then I'll have it set and I'll do that for the rest of my life. That's not how I operated at all. I don't know how to do that. It's funny, I just read Sonny Rollins said something like, I could never repeat my lines because I'm not a good enough musician to remember them. I read that. It's like, yeah, I mean, the trick is to keep things flowing. And so if you keep things flowing, they change.
Right, right. And what kind of guitar you have here today? I was trying to...
That's an Eastman AR-810. It's a 17-inch kind of orchestral size archtop guitar.
Beautiful guitar.
Thanks. It's nice. I haven't completely set on which acoustic guitar I want. I haven't completely figured it out.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as flexible as I like it to be, but it has a good old school kind of sound. I'm like... you know, in a lot of ways, really traditional about playing the guitar. And I do listen to Eddie Lang, and I do listen to Django, and I do listen to Charlie Christian still. I always have listened to those guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think to me, it's just making up music on the guitar. That's it. That's all this is. I mean, for all, you know, it's 100 years of basically people making up music on the guitar that stretches people's hearing, you know. There's no difference.
Right.
You know, I put Derek in that category, and Chad Bourne in that category, and Wes Montgomery and Hendrix, and a lot of other people that invented things to play in the guitar.
Yeah.
You know, I try to be one of them. That's it.
Yeah. And so while you guys were playing, I was peering through the window and trying to see your guitar, and then I started feeling bad. I was like, you know, I probably wouldn't think to ask Nate, what kind of trumpet are you playing?
That's right.
Are trumpeters as big of geeks about their instruments as guitarists?
Thanks.
You know, I think there is a subset of trumpeters that are that are that way, but I'm not one.
No.
I remember living in Denver and playing with certain guys, playing with Tony Klatka, who was in Blood, Sweat, and Tears at some point, and him showing up with a bag of mouthpieces and changing mouthpieces all the time. But I've had the same... I had the same horn until I dropped it on the ground, and now I have this horn.
Right.
And it's just a common... You know, I did this strange talk with Dave Douglas a while back, and he actually... at the beginning told everybody what horns we were playing, and when he said mine, I had to look. I was like, oh yeah, this one.
It's the one I didn't drop, it works
for me, and it sounds good, and it's beat up at this point, and so I'm not that type, but there's an upside and a downside. You know, some of those guys that do pay that much attention to their equipment probably have an easier time playing in general than I do, but I just deal with what I have. Feels comfortable. So,
right, and just to get myself off the geek table here.
I actually meant me, Joe. Not
you.
Yeah,
okay, good. I had the same guitar for years until it burned up in a fire, and then I got another one just like it, and now I have a kind of a solid body, you know, thing. And the acoustic doesn't work with drums, which is why they invented this solid body, because it feeds back. That's all there is to it. But the other thing is with an extended tailpiece, you know, you can get things past the bridge. You can get things past the neck. And you can't get that very well. You know, you're basically playing the pickups when you're dealing with a solid body guitar. And that's one set of skills. And playing the strings, that's a different set of skills, you know.
But guitars are like, you know, like I saw Chad Bourne play once, and he had a Bo Diddley replica of the rectangle guitar. You know, that's... That doesn't happen with trumpets or saxophones.
Not really,
nobody's
no.
like,
no,
oh, he's got a mock-up of a, yeah. you know, of a whatever.
Yeah, there's a certain kind of, you know, class of guitar player, like Nate was saying, that, you know, knows every sort of pickup and amp configuration. And, you know, they know that if they use this type of wah-wah pedal with that type of distortion box through this kind of amp, set a certain way, that they're going to get a particular sound that they heard someplace.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And I consider that to be like a, you know, a kind of virtuosity. You know,
yeah.
You know, it really is. It's a very complex kind of virtuosity. I've never really been able to key into it. I don't have that much interest in it. You know, I plug my stuff into the amp and turn all the knobs to zero. you know, I don't do anything to it really.
So I wanted to ask you a really corny, stupid question, and the reason is because this article I just read. Did you hear about this Larry Oakes concert he just did?
Yeah.
Did you see that show?
Yeah, I did.
He well, for the listeners, in case you didn't see it, he was playing a festival in Spain, right?
Yeah.
And somebody called the police because it was a jazz festival, and his group, which is the Drumming Corps, is a brilliant record, but they weren't playing jazz, and somebody complained to the police.
Yeah.
Which now we have it as the Jazz Police. Yeah,
exactly.
It's been a joke for a long time, and here we are.
It's about time it finally happened.
So, what we heard today, are you playing jazz?
I don't think I'm playing jazz. I actually don't give a damn about jazz anymore. I don't... That's a harsh thing for me to say, and I actually said I was never going to say it in public, but...
The mic's not on.
Yeah. Well, the sense of... I'll be as brief as I can. The sensibility about what jazz is, I think, is, you know, a really incredibly beautiful thing that will never leave me. I'm a second-generation jazz musician. Nate is, too, by the way. My uncle was a drummer in 1919 or something.
Wow.
Played in New York, you know, was famous and everything. And so
who
my...
Did he play with?
He played with Vincent Lopez and...
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Tony Pastor and guys like that. You know, my perspective on this is, like, if you put rhythm and melody together, anybody can call it jazz, and that's great. If it comes from a particular perspective, it can be jazz, it isn't jazz. But I think about my uncle a lot recently, last decade or so, and thinking about the fact that when he and his peers were making music, I guess they thought it was jazz for a few years or so, but they didn't know how to make it jazz. You know, I mean, we've had 85 years where jazz became this kind of tyrannical sort of industry, which hasn't, you know, which results in people calling the cops, you know. So I'd rather just not really call what I do jazz anymore. If somebody
so
says
you don't get the cops called on you.
Well, you know, if you think about all the aesthetic things that people equate with jazz, a lot of them I totally, completely relate to, and most of my heroes would fit into that category. But I don't think any of my heroes who fit into that category would say, yeah, we're playing jazz.
Right.
I think they just say they're playing their music.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I have a weird relationship with that term growing up in the 80s and 90s during the height of the Young Lion period,
right.
And Downbeat. You know, growing up in a small town where everything I heard about jazz was through Downbeat, and,
yeah.
You know, not really. There was some radio, but my dad's a jazz saxophonist, and so I grew up on the older records, and before I grew up on those before I started reading Downbeat and seeing, like, Roy Hargrove and Wynton Marsalis and all these guys. And the deeper I got into them, the more I realized that jazz kind of was just a marketing term, you know, because
mm-hmm.
you go back and listen to, there's something different between listening to Bix Beiderbecke or Charlie Shavers or Lee Morgan and listening to something that has the word jazz stamped all over it now.
Yeah.
And I'm already a little bit sensitive to marketing in general.
Right.
So the second for me that I kind of made this realization that the word jazz has become a symbol for a marketing ploy to sell records or in magazines or something, I automatically kind of recoil at the word now.
Sure.
There are definitely things that like Joe said, I identify with jazz that I do still. And I, you know, I play in bands where I'm playing chord changes and overtime, which to me I equate with jazz, but
mm-hmm.
the word for me I don't particularly use. I don't feel like what we did today is
mm-hmm.
is doing that. I mean, I think of the things that I do as kind of like, this is the thing that I play with Joe is like singing, in that I just play what I hear, and then there are things where I play less of what I hear and the mind is more active and it's less of a complete flow from kind of a singing type flow straight out through the horn of what I hear. And I guess the things where the mind is more involved, I think of as closer to that sort of music of jazz.
Right.
Or as I perceive that word. And this I think of more as just singing or playing. You know?
And of course, I mean, all three of us at the level that goes beyond words are all jazz fans.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I mean,
absolutely.
I've been thinking recently like about the word, like some of the most important composers of all in the world now,
mm-hmm.
like Anthony Braxton, in my opinion, Anthony Braxton, Henry Threadgill,
mm-hmm.
it's people that are really doing composed work, making up their own systems. I just don't think that word's doing them any favors in their place
well,
in history now. It's like, no, these are our composers.
It didn't do, you know, if you look, I have some books on 20th century music and Duke Ellington is not in those books.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, I mean, that in itself is enough to you know, make you understand that the term limits people. I think the question is it the audience that's limiting us? I don't think so. It's really what, you know, Nate just said. There's a sort of industry marketing thing that says we can sell this to those people if you keep it within these boundaries. But, you know, the silly part of that is if people kept things in boundaries, there would be no music, there'd be no culture, there'd be nothing. You know, business has nothing to do with creativity. You know, it's not to say people aren't in business, aren't creative, blah, blah, but we're trying to expand. Well, my friend Lowell Davidson used to say, it's about evolution. We're trying
mm-hmm.
to find how to use sounds to connect with people. And that's what my uncle did. You know, he played with Bix Beiderbecke back in the day and the Dorsey brothers and stuff like that. They tried to make music. They just, they had influences that, you know, were behind them, and they had a culture around them. And that's what we have, you know, except
mm-hmm.
that ours might include Xenakis and Hendrix and you know, and Anthony Braxton, you know, and if you said tradition, I I have my students play some Anthony Braxton music, and I put it in front of them. I say, this was written in 1973. You know, that's, you know, 36 years ago.
Right.
When I was in 1973, 36 years ago, was in the 30s. You know? That was, you know, that was a long time ago. And it was, you know, so old school then was new to the people making it. And mm-hmm. I just try to have that perspective all the time. That I think we need to all move on past the limitations of all that stuff. We're in a new century. And by the way, the old century started with people doing really incredible stuff on brass instruments, you know? So, you know, Nate Woolley is one of those people doing really incredible stuff on brass instruments. So it puts me in a position where maybe I could try to play what's appropriate on the guitar with, you know, one of the great brass players of the day. You know, in 100 years, are they going to say 200 years ago there was, or 180 years ago there was Bix Beiderbecke, then there was Nate Woolley? You know, that's how I look at it. It's like, here we are now. These are the parameters. Call it whatever you want.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it has been an interesting time for a trumpet. With
absolutely.
It's yourself, the instrument.
Peter Evans and Greg Kelly, and there's some...
Yeah, Taylor.
Surprising Taylor, sure.
And Axel Dorner. And a lot of the young kids I know, the trumpet players, are the most inventive. They have really good role models, and they're really stretching. They can't get the saxophone players to do that much.
Yeah.
The guitar players are pretty much, but brass players are really, really stretching.
I wonder if maybe the trumpet, you know, at this point in time just feels more open. There's more room to explore than have so much has been done with guitar and saxophone.
Yeah. I think there was an era too, I mean, for Greg and I mean I can't speak for Greg and Peter and Taylor, but for me, there was such a restriction on what the trumpet should sound like when I was growing up because of the dominance of Wynton Marsalis and the way that they were presented as the models of what that was and the tradition of it, that there's going to be a backlash at some point. I mean, there's going to be a reaction to it, and it, in hindsight, it doesn't surprise me that all of a sudden all these guys came out of the woodwork. I mean, there were all these people playing that stuff during that time too, like Herb Robertson and Paul Smoker and
Leo
Smith, and it's like, but they weren't the people you heard about, so was only a matter of time before certain people got fed up and searched for those folks and then came out of a different tradition, I think.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you sort of look back, the stuff that was really corny and really tyrannical musically, you know, in the 20th century, no one really pays any attention to the stuff that's one way or another cutting edge, you know, that kept looking forward. What I like to call free music, meaning it's a simple term for me to say people who were freely trying to not become conventional. Mm-hmm. They were constantly trying to evolve so that they were a little bit different than what the convention was, you know. That's the music we listen to. That's the music we study. That's the music that's important, you know. So I prefer to call what we did free music. Mm-hmm. It's not that we're not playing with structure and implied structure and, you know, we're listening and we have a lot of technical things we're using, but the approach is not to have it be something that someone can recognize with other references. It's more to be something that surprises them. And, you know, obviously there's interpretation and there's synthesis of ideas and there are references in it, but we're reconfiguring them and making them happen on the spot. So it's a new experience. It certainly is a new experience for us.
Uh-huh.
We stopped some time ago. That was interesting. I mean, it's pretty open music what we're playing.
Yeah. You
know? Well, thanks for bringing it up. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Joe Morris and Nate Woolley. And do you have any questions for each other?
No, but I will mention that we do have a CD coming out on Clean Feed that Nate found a beautiful title for. It's called Tooth and Nail.
Nice.
So when's that coming out? That's my question to you, Nate. When
is
the damn thing
coming out? Early 2010, I think.
Yeah, pretty soon. It's in production. It should be out pretty soon. And it's really good. And it's even different than what we played today, wouldn't you say?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely.
Every performance we've done has been different, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, radically different.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Thanks again, guys.
Thank you.